Welcome to Ask the Experts, a monthly podcast taking on the latest questions around healthcare legislation and compliance.
Welcome to today's episode of Ask the Experts. With us today is Shelley Bloom, Director of Legislative Awareness and Training. Before we begin today's podcast, I would like to read the following disclaimer. This podcast is designed to highlight various employee benefit matters of general interest to our listeners. It is not intended to interpret laws or regulations or to address specific client situations. You should not act or rely on any information contained herein without seeking the advice of an attorney or a tax professional. Now, Shelley, my first question is, can an employer offer benefits to one who is paid by a 1099?
Hi, Jim. In most cases, I would say that answer is no, because a 1099, someone who is paid by a 1099, is a contractor or subcontractor, hence they are not an employee. This is an ongoing thing with the federal government. They are still trying to determine how an employer figures out if a person is an employee or if they are paid by 1099 and truly a contractor. The reason why I can't answer it for every state is there are some states, not like New York, which do allow a 1099 person to be put on an employer's plan, but most of the rest of the states do not allow that. If there is not an employer-employee relationship, such as what you'd have with a 1099 contractor, then they cannot be on the benefits.
Now, Shelley, can an employer waive the waiting period for a particular employee?
The answer to that would be no. Usually you are disclosing the waiting period to the carrier that you are signing up with. So it might be first of the month following 30 days. It might be the maximum of the 90-day waiting period. But that needs to be the waiting period for everyone. You can't make an exception for just one particular employee.
Our third question, Shelley. An employer has a brief orientation period before employment begins. What is the start date of employment and the waiting period?
Jim, here we're talking about orientation period where an employer may bring somebody in and say that you have to go through a week or two or three before they determine if you are suitable for the job. So that is your start date. You're being paid for the time when you're in orientation. But under the ACA, in around 2015, they came out with specific rules that says an orientation period can be 30 days minus a day. So you can have up to 29 days of an orientation period. And if the employee is a go and you're going to continue on because they're able to do the work, then you would begin the waiting period at the end of that maximum 29-day orientation period. So the start date is the date they actually begin with you. But when you start counting the waiting period, that would be once they have completed that orientation period, no longer than 29 days.
An employee is enrolled in a qualified high deductible health plan with her employer. Can she choose to contribute to an HSA or FSA?
Yes, she can choose whether or not she, whatever plan she wants to enroll in. A lot of times when an employer chooses a qualified high deductible health plan, the employer also wants to set up that health savings account for each of the employees. The employer may even contribute a little bit to the plans for the employees, but that employee can choose whether or not they want to enroll in the health savings account. And remember the benefits of the health savings account. It belongs to the employee. Any money that goes in there remains with that employee. The employee can spend it however they want. As long as they spend it on 213D expenses, then there is not going to be any tax charge when it comes out. They spend it for something else, then it does. But the employee can also decide to enroll in the flexible spending account instead of the health savings account. Remember, with the health flexible spending account, that there is a ceiling that is set every year by the IRS, the maximum amount that the employee can put in. And basically, it's a use it or lose it type provision. So whatever amount of pre-tax dollars the employee and, in rare occurrences, the employer decides to put into that account, they need to spend in that 12-month period. If they don't spend it, yeah, there's a chance they could carry it over, have a brief grace period, but it's still a use it or lose it. So there are definite differences. Because the employee has a qualified high deductible health plan, they can use the health savings account opportunity that the employer set up. If the employer doesn't do that, the employee can go to their own bank or credit union to set that up, or they can choose not to do anything with their health savings account. They don't want to create one and just put dollars into the flexible spending account.
An employee enrolls in the qualified high deductible health plan at her employer. This includes coverage for their spouse and two children. Can they contribute the maximum amount for the family? If she and her husband divorce, does he get some of the money in her HSA?
So the operative thing in that question is about who is the owner of the HSA. The health savings account is a savings account that is owned by one person. So in this example, she is the employee, so she is the owner of the health savings account. She can choose to pay for copay, coinsurance, deductible, and other things that are 213D expenses for her children, for her spouse. But the only owner of that money is her. If her husband wants to have his own plan, he could choose to set up his own account and he could contribute some money to that plan that, again, could be used by the whole family, but then that money would be his. As far as the divorce and does he get some of it, I suppose they could work some of it out, but just in reality, her money is her money. That's what she puts in there, so she is the sole owner of that.
Question six, Shelley. John Doe's daughter is pregnant and delivers a child. Can John Doe cover the grandchild on his plan?
No. John Doe's daughter would be covered, so all of her maternity expenses and delivering the child would be covered under John Doe's plan because John Doe's daughter is his dependent. But now we're adding a grandchild to the mix. A grandchild is not a named dependent. John Doe could choose to adopt her, or he would be chosen to be her guardian. Then he could add her, but generally, if the daughter is going to remain the person who is responsible for John Doe's grandchild, then she would need to seek coverage somewhere else, like through a CHIP program through a particular state, or an individual plan, or some other way of covering that child.
Can an employer offer employee-only coverage? No coverage offered for spouse and dependents.
So the operative word in your question there is offer. Under the Affordable Care Act, the employer, if they're offering coverage, must offer coverage to their employee and to the dependents. It does not say that the employer needs to pay for the coverage for that dependent, but it does say that you need to offer coverage up to age 26. So the employer could require that the employee pay 100% of the dependent coverage, but that dependent offer of coverage must be extended. The ACA also says that a spouse is not a dependent, so the employer is not required to offer coverage for the spouse, but they must for the dependent.
A small employer, under 50, offers coverage to the employees. Can one of the employees choose to remain on an individual plan, or must he enroll on his employer's plan?
So the employer is offering coverage to everybody. This particular employee would prefer to stay on the individual plan, and it is his or her choice to do that. That person can remain on the individual plan. The other concern here is about whether or not that individual got a subsidy or tax credit when they purchased that individual plan. Because let's say this employer is offering coverage to everybody starting in 2023 for the first time. In that case, the individual may have had that subsidy or tax credit to help pay for the plan. Now that individual will need to disclose, hey, my employer is offering a plan they are contributing a little bit of the cost, which will then mean that the employee may lose some or all of that subsidy or tax credit. So it is always a choice of the employee to decide whether or not they want the employer plan or an individual plan, and then the subject of tax credit or subsidy would be a secondary thing that would need to be addressed.
Can an employer require different contribution amounts based on years of service?
Yes, they can. Years of service is one of those that is recognized. It should be written down in your handbook, in your SPD, or your RAP document to describe how you are going to base that contribution based on years of service, like 0 to 2, 2 to 5, 5 to 10, and you can have contributions that may increase based on that. And everybody that fits in that class would get it. It would also be good to explain when that trigger happens. So if I get my years of service in, my 5 years in June, do I move to the new contribution level in June, or do I wait until the next open enrollment after that? So the employer can avoid a lot of headaches if they think of all those little twists and turns and write it down. But yes, years of service and different contributions is okay.
We heard a lot about the family glitch going away recently. Can you tell us a bit more about what that means to the individual and the employers?
Yes, family glitch is something that we've talked about a lot ever since the Affordable Care Act began. If you remember, we talked about the employer should offer coverage to the employees, especially to their particular employee. And in the beginning, you were to take in the income of all of the family to determine whether coverage was affordable. The employer doesn't know what everybody in every family makes, so they gave us the three safe harbors to determine if coverage was affordable for the individual. So what happened with the family glitch is if coverage was determined to be affordable to you, Jim, then it would also be determined to be affordable to your spouse and to your dependents, even though you may need to pay 100% of that cost for the spouse and the dependents. They then were not eligible to go to the individual plan to get tax credit or subsidy because your plan was deemed affordable. That was certainly a problem. It is now fixed starting January 1. So if you have a spouse and kids, your spouse and kids will now be able to go to the marketplace or to their state-based plan or to healthcare.gov, and they will be able to disclose in now additional questions that will be asked. Does your employer offer coverage? If you don't have an employer, does your spouse's employer offer coverage? How much do they contribute to that? And this whole thing is to determine, is the coverage that is offered affordable to the person who needs the coverage? So now it will be okay in many cases for a spouse or dependents to be able to go to the marketplace and to be eligible for tax credit or subsidy. It's still based in part on what the total family has as income. And if you are the employee of your employer, you are not eligible for tax credit or subsidy because your employer is offering a contribution to your plan. But your spouse and dependents can now be eligible for and receive that tax credit or subsidy. From the employer's perspective, as we're going through open enrollments that are happening for January 1 and going forward, it's important that the employer tell the employees that there is a change in the law and they need to be aware of this. And they can go to their state-based exchange or to healthcare.gov to figure out if their family may qualify for additional help. Along with that, the employer also needs to be aware that if they have a plan year that is not synced up with the calendar year, in other words, their renewal date would be in March or April or May, then they may need to make an adjustment to the pre-tax contributions part of their Section 125 or their premium-only plan to allow someone to come off of that plan in the middle of a year. It's not a requirement that the employer make that change, but it's a suggestion as a part of these family glitch rules. So it does complicate things a little bit, but it also makes them a lot easier and hopefully a lot more affordable for every family, for every employee to look at his or her own family and say, how do I make all of the insurance coverage more affordable for all of us?
Thank you, Shelley. And we hope you found this podcast helpful and informative. If you have any questions, then please contact your account manager or salesperson directly. Thank you, everyone.